Welcome to Code Splitters Podcast. I'm Paul.
I'm Mikkel.
And I'm Kevin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Code Splitters. We have a new kind of episode for you this time around because we have a guest on. And we are going to be talking about front-end and UX collaboration, how we work together, both in tooling and personally. So first off, let's introduce our guest. It's actually a former colleague. We have Thomas Hjortsberg, the senior UX and team lead at DocWise, if I remember correctly. He moved far, far away to the northern part of Jutland, so he's not that close anymore. But we're so happy to have you here, Thomas. Welcome aboard.
Thank you so much, guys. And thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to join your awesome podcast here. I've been a regular listener for some time now. So thanks.
Thanks for helping us keeping the statistics going up. Cool. So what we have planned for today is that, of course, now that we have Thomas here, that we want to talk a little bit about not just front-end development, of course, but we're going to be talking about how we deal with deliverables from UX, and also, like, you know, what does the UX part of it entail, like, you know, prepping stuff and then the handover, the workflow and how we deal with that. So first of all, Thomas, I think a very good question here is, of course, I guess you've been working for like a long while in the UX space. So you've been working with lots of different kinds of developers. So we can sort of just, you know, I think we can move directly into workflows and UX. Like, what is your job as a UX in a project?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Paul. Yeah, so I think I've been working in the field of UX for approximately, is it 12 or 13 years now? And it's always been a big part of my job to work with developers. And it's kind of also been the constant in my career. You know, tools have changed, how we approach design and how we approach client and strategic UX and all that. That has been subject to change, but the constant and always been that you need to be good at maintaining a good collaboration and friendship and, you know, being good employees and being good teammates with developers is always a big part that you need to improve on and be better at. So it's an awesome topic, and I think it's one that, especially as a young UX designer, you need to focus on from day one. I guess my process for working together with developers and doing handover in development has changed somewhat over the years. I started out in a company where we had very, very rigid processes. We were subject to something called CMMI5, which was the standard for project management. And it was so rigid. So developers would need to get my signature, like physically signature, for an approval of a of a UI component. That was how stupid that was at the time. So if I was going home on Friday, I would suddenly have a young developer running after me in order to get my signature before I went out the door, because otherwise he couldn't go home. He's putting it on the internet.
You have to wait for the carrier pigeon.
True. Yeah. So I was sort of started out in the overboard model. But over the years, it has become more and more, agile, lean, but still somewhat structured, I would say. So what am I doing these days? And I'm also teaching this to my team up here in Aalborg. We're quite a young team, but we take a lot of responsibility on our deliverables. We are usually responsible for maintaining the backlog and sort of helping out product owners getting the backlog ready for development. So that's a big part of our job. That also means that we need to ensure that the developer UX collaboration is running smoothly. So let's assume that a UX designer and a product owner, developer, architect, whatever, has been going through, a project has started. We have a feature. It's not the first feature, but we're in a project and we need features to, it could be features or a value stream or an epic. I don't really care, but features is the structure that most often has directed developments in the companies I've been. So if I say feature or epic, that could be interchangeable. So this feature has been ready for development, or say made ready for implementation. We have finished the business requirements. We have gone over the epic. We have written up all the stories. They have acceptance criteria. We have links in Figma, which leads to inspectable mockups for developers. So what do we do now? Well, so the first thing is that actually way before this, I would normally go and talk to the developers before we get into this, because, well, you could look at yourself and say, okay, how would I feel if somebody just dumped a design or on me at some point, or if the product owner came to me and said, pushed a paper with a design and say, could you prettify this or whatever? So I think the process and handover start way before we actually go into the business requirement. I start to pitch ideas with the developer. And yeah, we have worked, Paul, together in the past closely, right? And you know that I would come to you before and just swing it by you and say, okay, what are your thoughts? Where do we have some challenges here? What do we see, right? So it already starts there to get the developer input on what we are about to do. But then when we're about to go into development, I have this saying that you always need to be 2 to 3 sprints ahead of development. And here I'm assuming that development is doing Scrum. If they're doing Kanban, you need to find out what is their velocity and be ahead of that. But 2 to 3 sprints, regardless of what frequency developers are doing sprints with, have always proven to me to be the just in time, the right fit there, because sometimes it will only be 1 week, sometimes it's 4 weeks, sometimes you're spot on. But if you're ahead of development, priorities can change and you will still have some pretty groomed backlog that you can start developing on and that won't get too much rework on. So I would like to do then a epic kickoff with the developer who is leading the feature of the epic and go over the epic and say, okay, here is the overall design, here is the concept, and then we go over the stories, not all the acceptance criteria, and the developer would have prepared, so what are the questions? Why did you decide this with the product owner? What happened here? And okay, what you have designed there, couldn't we optimize that? And I would say in 9 out of 10 times, although I have involved the developer before here, the developers will still have good input. How can we do stuff smarter, right? So it's also, if I do this kickoff 2 to 3 sprints before development, then I actually have time to also get some of that input into the stories and go back to the product owner and say, hey, can we do this smarter? And I like to tell myself that this is also more motivating for the developer if he doesn't get the story epic handover on the day that he needs to start developing. So the developer also feels that this is still negotiable and there's still... There's still a thing that can be optimized. Yeah.
I can confirm that as a front-end developer. I think it's because we have this kind of pipeline thing where you get a project and you define all the business requirements, and it goes into design phase and this and UX phase or together, and then it kind of gets like handed over to the developers, and they're like, here you go, build. But it's very nice to have someone like a UXer reach out to you beforehand and be like, look, I'm toying with this idea. Would that be viable? Or do you have any other like opinions? And as you say, also just before, instead of just getting like, here's five tasks, go. It's nice to maybe the week before or a couple of weeks before just be like, hey, this is the current mock-up or the current idea of how this feature or thing should work. And do you have any, valuable input or any like comments, or is there anything that will take, this might be like a small part of the design that will take like a lot of time compared to the other stuff, and then maybe you can kind of tweak that around, I think. So yeah, speaking as a developer, thank you for that. It's very it's very nice to have UX be a bit ahead and kind of know what's coming. It also sometimes helps you what you're currently building to kind of know what's in the pipeline coming afterwards. So,
exactly. Yeah. But it's also about responsibility for UX, because I kind of think like, though we call ourselves UX designers, I don't believe that UX is something that designers are solely responsible for defining. There are way too many examples where it's a joint responsibility to get the perfect UX right. And there's sometimes where I would like the developer to actually drive the direction for the UX. Let me try and give one example. Just the other day, we were about to do an order management system. And one of those things that we're doing is that we need to have a table component, which is heavy editable. And I could sit down as a UX designer and spend 2 months specifying how the focus state on the cell should be. Should I press enter when I enter edit mode? But I believe it's far more efficient to go out to the developer some time ahead and say, well, can you help me here? Can you? What should we do? Should we build this ourselves? Should we look into something? I kind of think the requirements are in this area. What would your idea be? What components should we choose? And if I go out in time, I also experience that developers would actually start coming up with design ideas, right? Well, you should not press enter to enter edit mode. You should just start typing and then you edit the cell, right? And stuff like that that I don't necessarily think of because I'm busy with defining and designing business process with the product owner. But I believe that those micro interactions are the thing that will help, or at least partly define the success when we launch in 2 or 3 months, right? So so it's not only about being ahead in time, it's also about getting developers on board on feeling responsible for the UX of the solution.
I think it's also about being agile, right? Because if you have to specify everything up front, down to the tiny little bit of detail, then you are like approaching like a big specification and like a more of a like waterfall model, maybe. So I think the collaboration and like just talking together is way more efficient. And also, like you, as you said, you also get a lot more buy-in from the developer and like a feeling of responsibility or like a shared responsibility. So I think that's far more valuable. So yeah, I agree.
And I also learned stuff. That's very important to me, right? I think a lot of what I know today about UX has also come from developers. So it's it's a two-way street.
Yeah, I was going to say that works both ways, and and you both had a good point on, you know, like responsibility and you know, including the developer more in that, because I've historically seen as well when we're working with like third party developers somewhere out in the world, where they are just given a task, whatever. Maybe it's more waterfall for them, you know, I don't know their constellation, but that seems usually to be the thing, right? They're not as invested in what they're building because that's just a deliverable, because they never get asked, you know, they just get that specification. Maybe it actually just is a list of, you know, bullet points, you know, it should do this, 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 and this, and everything besides that, they don't care about that at all. And of course, you know, there are different developers and stuff like that, but there you can really see the difference of, you know, including people, giving them some responsibility and including them in processes beforehand, rather than just saying, you know, here's your deliverable, go build, right?
Yeah, but that's true. I must say I'm unsure whether it's a problem related to sourcing or whether it's a problem for not involving developers enough in the client interaction, because I think the same thing, I've seen that happen with local Danish developers. If they are not getting involved in the client interaction and the client don't see them as a advisor as well as a developer, there are sometimes reasons why it has to be that way. You could be on a fixed price contract, God forbid it, where you need to deliver something on time and you just need all hands on deck, developers need to code, and yeah, actually I don't think it's a good reason, but it's how we end up in order to meet a date set in a contract sometimes. But it should not be the way it is. I have also developed or experienced developers abroad that if they are involved with the client and the client see them as a trusted advisor, then that could also work. But we need, as designers, business analysts, and whatever we call ourselves, to involve developers more in that early interaction before backlog items are developed.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. To go back to a little bit like the pipeline of how it goes through design, UX, and stuff like that, it's also just a lot easier to get some changes in before kind of the client the client acceptance of a feature or component. That's when it might get difficult to actually go back and change stuff because I need to approve it again, etc. So I think the depends on the team you have. If you have very few people, maybe it's a good idea that maybe all the developers have some kind of relation to one or some of the clients, so they know them as well. If it's a bigger team, I guess it would be more like the lead developer, maybe that would have the relation. And I think it is also really important to involve the developers with the client.
I actually often advocate for a solution where we point out leads per epic, if possible. Because I think it is something that every developer should at least try out to see if the client interaction and the business requirements gathering process is something they like. And they should also know what does that involve, because it's also difficult. I think some developers who don't like to touch that part of the process will just sometimes sit and look, what are they doing? Why is this taking so long? And they spend so much time. Why did they only come up with this? And so on, right? But if as soon as you get involved in that process, I think it also gives you some, should I call it empathy for the people trying to come up with the requirements, right? So,
I think it's a really good point. I have been in projects in the past, and I've gotten to say it's gotten a lot better lately, I think, with involving developers earlier. But I've been in some projects in the past where developers were involved really late in the project, where everything was already kind of defined and signed off, and then you're like, yeah, you're a little bit, you feel a little bit stuck, I guess, because you don't want to, you know, everything's been signed off and everything has been planned and maybe sprints have been planned ahead. And you're like, well, I should just build this and shut up because we can go back. Yes. And then sometimes you feel a little bit like, but this could maybe have been done better, or we have this other component we can maybe reuse, but they didn't know it. And, you know, things like that. So it's definitely something. I think
you have like 10 different ideas for improving, but you can't. It's just set in stone already. So
you feel like it's too late.
You're building inside a vacuum.
Yeah. Cool. But that was, I think that was really cool. I guess sort of introduction, not maybe already a long nice explanation of how you see the collaboration and the process and stuff. But I'm also kind of curious about how do you like the collaboration with the developers once the development is undergoing. So let's say you're in the sprint and you're working on features and developers are building stuff. And maybe you have a, I don't know, it also depends a lot on the project. Maybe you have a component library somewhere, or you have a test server where you can kind of see things in advance. And I'd be very interested to know how you see and how you prefer the collaboration going while we're developing on these features and giving your feedback during the process.
And that's so, that's the difficult part right now. I've spoken about the handover. That's the easy part. How the difficult part starts. It's funny now that you said, I come to remember that when I started out, when I was a junior at the company, my mentor would say to me, he was a senior UX designer and really good, worked with companies as eBay and Systematic before that. He would say to me, and I had this bright and shiny design ready for development. And then I was just, now I'm done, I'm out. And he would say to me, Thomas, you're never better than what is on the build server. And I'm so old that we had build servers at that point in time. But I think it was a really, really good point that you can have all your shiny designs, but it's what's deployed that that matters, right? So I think that is something that we, especially as designers, should not underestimate. And you guys are definitely not doing it right, but it's also like you can, well, how could you, sort of. But we as designers sometimes forget that we should make the sprint as good an experience and a quality deliverable is something we have a big part in securing. So what do we actually do? So we haven't talked about tooling yet, but well, I guess most developers, designers know, are doing Figma these days. I haven't spoken to a person who hasn't been doing designs in Figma for quite a while. So with Figma comes design system and inspection and all of that good stuff, right? And that has definitely made the job so much easier. And I think that designers are more structured in how we design and organize design systems today than we were just 5 years ago. So that makes a huge difference in itself. But that's like a topic in itself we might return to. So that makes a lot of stuff more easy. But there's still like, so now if we talk within the Epic, there's this story and that needs to get developed. Because in the handover, we are sitting down, developers, designers, and product owners is often also there. And we have agreed that the acceptance criteria for that story is, that is what we're aiming for. That is the ambition, right? But stuff always happened under developing. We get wiser. We find out that this acceptance criteria might not fit the bill or what was the business purpose anyway, right? And sometimes we need to take things out. Sometimes we need to add stuff in. But one thing which can seem trivial, but which I'm really keen on, is that we always document our decisions in the backlog. And the backlog, if all is often contained in either Jira or Azure DevOps, in my experience. So as soon as we find out that here's something we can do smarter or here's something we need to update on the design, we go in and we either update the acceptance criteria or we write comments and get the input from the product owner. And that is regardless of whether I'm on a which contract I'm on with the client, or if I'm sitting in-house, I think it's super important to get the decisions into Jira so that it's visible for everyone. Why did we end up where we were when we sit later on and start testing the story? Yeah. And that actually takes more time for designers than you would imagine when you start out as a designer. Often some of the young people that I have here, right, that is what surprises them the most. What does it actually take to do that? Stakeholder management on the backlog item. But I think it's super important. And it's one of those things that ensure the quality result in the end. There is also, because I want to be 2 to 3 sprints ahead, that's also because I want time to be able to be there for developers when implementation starts, because then I can take out half an hour, whatever Paul needed when he calls me up sometimes, right? Say, Thomas, what have you done here? And how should I interpret this? Because
what yeah, in the name hell?
No. Yeah, exactly. Because though we did agree on some acceptance criteria, there will always be questions. And there will always be, have you considered this? Have you done that? There needs to be time for that. And the 2 to 3 sprints is essential for ensuring that time when we go into development. I tend to say that you need to allocate as a designer at least between half a day or a day a week just to answer questions. Sometimes there is more, sometimes there's less. Hopefully it'll often be less, right? But it's always there and it should be there. Yes. So...
Yeah, sorry, Thomas. Just one quick thing. You mentioned this handover, and I know that we call it that as well, like a UX handover or design handover to the developers or to us frontenders. But should we really call it that? Because is it really like a one meeting handover? Like it's more like a fluid process, right? So now we have a meeting where we talk about it, and then implementation starts, and then. It's a cycle all over, right? Because we have questions and we talk together. And so maybe it's not really a handover, or maybe it's just a really long handover, like until it's done, right?
I was just quickly going to say, I usually like to call it the development kickoff instead.
Exactly.
That's when
that's also what I call it.
Actually starts.
Yeah. Now it's important. Yeah.
Before that, we don't care at all. No.
But that's an extremely good point, Mikkel. I actually hate the term handover. It's also like you cannot hear that, but I'm cleaning my hands and throwing it over the hedge, and now I'll hand it over to you, Mikkel. Take it away. Yeah. Call me 2 months later when you're done. No. So that's what's implied.
Now it's on to the next silo. Is there a job now?
Yeah.
So we should definitely drop that term. True. So that's sort of like when development is being done. So what happens when development for a backlog item is actually completed? And this is where I like to have what I call design QA. I would like, before we show it to the client or we go into user acceptance test or whatever it is, I would like there to be a sort of handshake between developers and designers, where you go in and you look at the what has been implemented on the pre-prod or the QA environment. I don't really care. It could also be locally with the developer. And you sort of say, well, did we meet the ambition we set out to meet? And hopefully we should be able to look at the backlog item and be able to say yes or no. The backlog item to me is like the contract for the ambition we have on a story. Did we meet it? Did we not meet it? But I also like to have this. We create an observation. Could be a story, could be a defect. I don't care. It's just an observation. where we in a flat list put all the observations we have. We used the wrong class here. We used the wrong color variable there. We should have made this field mandatory, or what do I know? All of these observations, we developers and designers sit, they might do it together, or the designer might do it, and we just list them. And then I would like the developer to go in and say, all the stuff here which I agree with and would take less than an hour or two to just fix without all the overhead of creating new backlog items in Jira, we just do that. Boom. As like no overheads, just do it, because it's so expensive if you put that into the QA environment of the client, and now we need to do all the creation of backlog items and discuss it and prioritize it and yada yada yada. It's so let's see if we can avoid that. But there will also sometimes be cases where developers might disagree that this was actually part of the acceptance criteria, or the designer might come up with a new acceptance criteria during the QA, because designers also get wiser. And then we need to sort of, and that would take more than 1 or 2 days perhaps to fix that one. And we need to isolate that from the rest, all the small things. And we need to put those into new backlog items that the product owner can evaluate and prioritize and say, is that more important than this other story? Yeah. So that's something I think is pretty important. And the ambition for this design QA kind of varies as a function to what kind of contract, or am I a consultant, or am I sitting in-house? Because if you're a product company and you, it's just, there's sometimes a higher quality focus because you know what is the cost of deploying the wrong thing. So if Thomas, if you and Kevin spend 3 hours, 4 hours, we don't care. Just make sure it's the best thing that we deploy to market here. But if you're on a fixed price contract with a, let's say, public sector client that doesn't have a lot of money, then you need to be on the point and only fix all the stuff that you're 100% sure that is cost efficient to fix short term, I would say. Yeah, so this became too theoretically, I think, but I hope you get the point that it's
it makes sense.
Yeah, I think as a developer, it's also super nice to do these reviews before. It depends, before either the component or the feature gets pushed to, as you say, QA or something like that. It's really nice just to get that approval after you've built it, and a designer can tell you like, yeah, this is pretty much my vision of the component, maybe minus this and that, and then you can say, okay, I'll just quickly fix this, or this will take too much time, and then you can maybe talk about if you should leave it out or add it in the next sprint or whatever. So I think, I also think it's really nice as a developer to not just get a wireframe or a design handed and then just build it, and then you're like, you push the code and you're like, I guess that was it, or is it? You're like, sure. Thinking like, is this deliverable? So it's really nice to just have a UX or a designer or both in some cases just approve it as well. It can be in many different ways. I've tried just a really quick approach. If you're sitting at the same office and you're like, hey, I'm almost done with this component, can you just drop by and come have a look? Because I'm not sure about the responsiveness of it or something. You can just come check. And then they will just point out some stuff and say like, yeah, maybe do this and that. And I think this has the wrong space in here. Oh yeah, I'll just fix that as well. And then it goes further into the process.
To add to that as well, because I remember when we implemented this, Thomas, at the client we were on together. And it was such a nice process, because when you're in, and I guess you can attest to that as well, right? Because when you're in like the sort of agile process, it's the client's agile process. It usually is for us as consultants, right? But but you remove a lot of the overhead and ceremonies by doing that as well, because you're just doing it like the designer, the UXer, and the developer together, right? As Kevin said, like, yeah, okay, I'll just quickly fix this. You know, it doesn't need to go through all the approvals that you might get if you went directly to the PO or something like that, because they have a different business take on it, right?
Exactly.
So yeah. You're also sort of shielding some of that away, which I think is essential as well, because developers don't necessarily like all that. Of course, as you said, I think there's a point to learning client interaction and what have you, but I think a lot of people are just like, ah, oh, we don't, you know, can we just fix, right? You know?
Yeah. And
I think every Oh, sorry, Kevin.
I just wanted to say, I think something that's important to that, or what I've learned as well when doing these design QAs regularly, is that it's really nice to touch up on some of the details regarding that. Because, yeah, as you say, if you have a product owner, they don't care if you use a space medium or large or whatever, right? They care about other stuff. So it's really nice when you sit together with a front ender and a designer, for example, you actually care about the details, and it makes the whole product in the end, it will make it just a little more nice and polished. So that's just what I wanted to add.
Exactly, because I think the business owners, the product owners side is also really important, because you're right, they don't care and they don't want to care until they do. Like when the design sort of, you know, if you do a lot of small quality errors, you can sort of hide them like for a while, but at some point in time, it just breaks down, because if you have too many small defects here and there in the design, the customers, the end users, will start losing trust in the overall system. And that's when hell breaks loose for the product owners. So they just want this to go away. they want it fixed before shit hits the fan, right? But they want it fixed. I remember the product owner that Paul and I had, she would always remind me, Thomas, I expect you and Paul to just shield me from this. I want the quality, but I don't want to be part of it. I pay you guys to ensure that it's good, right? And so, yeah. That's an important point to also, as you said, Kevin, take the business owners, the product owners, as a point of view in this.
I just want to add that I also think that the whole design QA, or like UX review, or what do we call it, is a really nice approach. And I like the way that you described the whole, like, take all the small things and just do them without creating items for them. That's a nice pragmatic approach. I really like that. I also want to add that we, like, on a lot of client projects, we use Storybook, which also I think it's a really nice tool for doing this kind of UX design collaboration or like reviews, because it's a nice tool that allows you to talk about the experience and the design in a way that doesn't require a lot of stuff, and you can get really going really fast, and like it takes small iterations, and you can, like, the feedback loop is really short, so it doesn't require you to deploy to a lot of environments and having a lot of database and servers involved. So that's really nice.
But Storybook has completely changed the game for UX designers when we talk about consistency. Mm. I remember when I started, consistency was something that the only way you could enforce it was by going around being a nagging idiot, telling developers that you didn't use the same dropdown here and there. But we were never able to point them to where would you see the catalog of components and what is it that we agree on, because we did feature-driven designs. We never built the design system together. We never ensured and because we didn't do that as designers, we were not able to say, what components do we have in stock? Should we optimize this component, or should we build another one for some other purpose?
You could have a style guide.
Nagging. Yeah, that was seldom in the companies I work yeah. with. It was a rare thing if we had even had a design guide.
Yeah.
But yes.
But that didn't also, like the design guide or style guide did not have any components, right? It was just typography and colors and stuff like that, right?
Yes, if we had one, it would only be the foundations or tokens or whatever we call these things.
And how the logo should look and so on. Should get some legal stuff, so yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I think we've already talked a little bit about tooling. We've mentioned Storybook, we've mentioned Figma. And I think that segues pretty beautifully into tooling as a thing here. Because Thomas, you mentioned like how dreadful it has been in the past from your point of view, but I guess that's also sort of, you know, it's also hit us, right? So nowadays we have things like Figma. What has that changed for you in like collaboration and details between developers and design and UX? And here I'm thinking about design tokens, but also just as Mikkel said beforehand, like components, like you can actually, you know, you have somewhere to put them and talk about them and edit them and you know, define them.
Yeah, it's such a big and important topic. And I think that tools and processes are not something you can isolate one or another from each other. So if we rewind back in time again, I'm sounding like an old idiot, but that's how it is. I'm getting old. When I started out, when we did a feature, we would do a 25 to 50 pages in Word user interface specifications, because Microsoft told us that that was the right way to do things, as I remember it. They had a process for UX engineering. So we did that. We just sat and we would write, there should be so much padding to the left, there should be so much padding to the right. And then after a month or so, we would dump that on the table of the developers and doing a true handover. That was how I remember handovers, right? That was when I looked in the dead eyes of the developer when he received that 25 pages words that I had written up. And that was dreadful.
This is purgatory.
True. And that was we did that for a long time, and truth be told, some of it actually worked. The parts where we described behavior and how things should work, what validation should we use, and the use case and stuff we wrote in there, some of it was actually really good. And I have try to keep that when I write epics today, but we spend so much time on specifying flat design, who was created in Adobe or GIMP or whatever the designer would use to create raster files to put in there. And it was just, those designs served no purpose other than showing what it was you intended. And it was, there was no guidance for the developers in implementing in those drawings, because truth was that developers wouldn't read those 25 pages. They would sort of go over it and say, yeah, okay, I probably know what this is. Let me try and do the best and see what Thomas says. And then we started from there. But then tools actually changed for my part. There came this tool for designers called Azure, I think, like Azure, but with an X instead of a C. And it made us dive into another rabbit hole, I believe. Some will disagree with me. But Azure was extremely good at creating high fidelity prototypes in terms of behavior and interaction. So we would spend, I don't know, sometimes I would probably spend 3 or 4 weeks building these extremely high fidelity prototypes, where it could be a web shop, it could be, anything. And it was so close to what the developers would actually end up building that I at least ended up asking, well, why did I just not code this? If I had the abilities to do proper backend development, then I might have done that instead of just wasting the time of doing prototypes. But let me just, so prototypes are great if you intend to put them in front of an end user and you want to test your concept before development. I like prototypes there. And prototypes might also work if you need to show something quickly at sea level in order to get an acceptance for direction. I'm not sure I like it, but it works. So prototypes they are legitimate in UX, but some years ago we spent way too much time diving down a rabbit hole just to make sure that developers would exactly understand how they should build what we intended. Because if we just showed them the prototype that could do everything, then they would develop it perfectly afterwards. Funny enough, that didn't work. And you have spent the first 2 weeks and the developer would ask you, why did you choose that? And you said, well, I don't know. I will go change it. And we had all the problems that developers had, that now we needed to build a new data model. We needed to take that jQuery repeater that was underneath the hood and totally restructure it. And I lost so much time because though I had the possibility to create a high fidelity solution, I missed all the debugging tools that you guys had. So I might as well just throw the prototype in the trash can and start over again as soon as the developer gave me some feedback. So we kind of put that in the trash can and said, well, let's stop spending time prototyping and instead try and go research end users and understand clients and their business priorities and let the developers do the developing and we do the design. Let's try that. That sounds more reasonable. And that's kind of where we've been for the last 5 years, where I think first sketch also actually, if you couple that with some other tools, either Envision, Zeppelin or so, you could also get some design that was actually valuable for the developers afterwards in terms of inspection and so on. But with Sketch and Envision, Zeppelin and so on, we also inherited some of the stuff that you guys have to work with every day, like Git, in order to collaborate with other designers. And truth be told, that might be too much overhead for designers to go in and merge and commit and do all of that stuff, right? So in came Figma, and Figma sort of took all of those pains away that you guys deal with every day from us designers, because we don't really need that. We could just merge on the fly. Figma does that for us behind the scenes, right? And from a design perspective, that really speeded up things, especially when you were more than one designer, that collaboration would be better. But it also made it possible to involve developers very, very early in the design. If you guys were bored one day, you could just go in and look, what is Thomas designing right now? Because you didn't need to install Sketch on your machine and you didn't need to find the files where I put that Sketch file and so on. And the same went for Sketch clients.
For Mac only.
Exactly. Mac only. And it has a license cost and you need to, it's not just, it didn't have a viewer concept, so to speak. So if you came in there, you could just knock yourself out and you needed to understand all of the design tools in order to make sense of it. You might live with that. The clients were scared as hell if I asked them to download Sketch. I never did that because, yeah. Why do that? But with Figma, developers, clients, UX designers, UI designers all entered into one tool. And that has made a huge difference. And I assume that's also why Adobe chose to pay $20 million.
Billion dollars. Order of magnitude larger.
Yes, true. And what an evaluation that is. But it makes sense, right? Because it seems hard to compete with, truth be told. Of course, there will be another tool in some years, right? But we're in a really, really good place now. And I will stop babbling in just 2 seconds. Another thing that really, if you remind me, I said we started out with Word documents, but now with Figma, we all of a sudden, we also have it with Sketch, but especially with Figma, we also got the opportunity to organize our designs into design systems and sort of be as structured as we require you guys to be. So why is that drop down not the same as that drop down over in that design? And if I went back and looked in my own files, I would also make those inconsistency errors, right? But with Figma, we are sort of obliged to live up to the same standards as we require from you guys and which you have in Storybook. So all of a sudden, the playing field is leveled and there is no longer a handover. There's just a collaboration between developers and designers. And you can comment on it as we go along and we can discuss it and I can redo it. And that's awesome.
Yeah, and it's really cool. You just mentioned Storybook and Figma together. I just want to add a very quick note that I recently found there's a Storybook plugin actually for Figma. So on more recent project, I actually tried using that. So you can link a Storybook component or even a variant of the component to a Figma component. So that's pretty cool. So then you get a few inspect the design in Figma, mm-hmm. And you select the component, you get on like the sidebar where you inspect all the CSS and all the design tokens and stuff. You actually get a link so you can see the component directly in Storybook, mm-hmm. and that's also pretty cool.
That's awesome
for collaboration. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've also just been on a project where where the developers just tied up the color variables in Storybook to the color variables in Figma, and so said, well, we don't care if you change to this or that hex code, right? Essentially, as long as we agree on the variables and whether they're semantic or whether they're called random stuff or whatever, then why not let designers take responsibility over the color variables?
Yeah.
So it's changing these days who takes responsibilities for what.
Yeah. That's really nice. So, Thomas, just a question to that. So do you then, or do the designers or the developers then go in and export the variables like once in a while or when it's changed, or is it like automatically getting it from somewhere?
So seen from my perspective, he is just automatically fetching it. I believe he has built a plugin for Figma, okay, or something like that, which is doing that. So, but from my end, how should I say it? It's a no-touch interaction. It's just if I change it, okay, it will change. I think he needs to accept and merge or whatever, right? He's getting notified that I've changed it.
Okay.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just get some mail.
Oh, that would be lucky.
But I should go and ask. I've just been so busy, and this is actually something I should be.
Well, it's really cool. It's quite interesting. But actually, I do have a question. I do want to go a little bit back. So when you talk about Figma and this feature of Figma where you can like create components, I think it's called components, right? So like reusable design inside of the design. So do you think, like, because it makes really good sense and you get a lot of consistency and so on, but do you think it requires more work for you as a UXer to actually create those components? Or does it maybe depend on your personality, like how structured you are? What do you think?
So my rule of thumb is that if I have to build more than one screen for a client, then the cost of doing the overheads has paid itself back.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I built a design system, the cost might not have been justified. But the sooner as you learn it and you, it's like I do it every time now. So the last project I was on, we have a split responsibility, UX and UI designer. But even for that means that I wireframe, they will do a branded design. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. If it's a big project, it makes sense to split it to a UI designer. But even in this case where I'm only to do the wireframes, I actually made a design system for wireframes because I still need to build a dropdown, whether it's in wireframes. And it takes me pretty much as long as it would to do a high fidelity one. So why not just do the components straight ahead? Once you have done it once, it's and I can reuse some of it from time to time, right? So it's I think it's a no-brainer. Yeah,
makes sense. It actually leads me to another question that I noted down, like what is your, like, and maybe you also already answered it, but like your opinion about wireframes versus prototypes versus design, like high fidelity designs, and we talked about it earlier as well, but like, yeah. Is there a wide right time for every version, or like for a prototype and a wireframe and a high fidelity design, on what do you think?
Yes, and that's a difficult topic that designers are continuously discussing, right? So when we entered Sketch and Figma, I'm sorry that I have to rewind back in time all the time. So when we let's start with, why did we split the responsibility of wireframes and high fidelity design? Well, back when it was all done in Adobe Photoshop and you had no way of building a design system that you could reuse, then it was a two-person task just looking at the hours of the task. So it made sense back then to split the responsibility. And it would, no matter how experienced a UX designer, UI designer was, where it would make sense to split the responsibility due to the hours it took to produce a high fidelity design concept. Yes. Then we have kind of stuck with that for a long, long time. And wireframes were important when we did all of that prototyping madness I talked about, because it's so much cheaper to prototype. So we also kept wireframing back then. But nowadays, when the cost of doing wireframes versus high fidelity design is close to zero, that's at least my my claim. We always need to reevaluate: do we do wireframes or do we leave them out? If you have experience as a UX UI designer in producing high fidelity design, and you perhaps have a brand designer who has done the brand design, then I would very often do the high fidelity designs just straight right away, instead of having an intermediate step, because it's the same cost whether I should do wireframe or high fidelity design. But when I get a new designer from school, straight out of university or wherever they come, that's a UX designer I'm talking about here. In Denmark, we often get UX designer out of university, whereas UI designers came from more practical educations. But the UX designer, I would recommend that they start in wireframes in order to learn the craft of doing UI design. You know, there's something called 8-point grid nowadays. You do baseline grids. You need to understand color variables. You need to understand basic principles of layout, 12 columns, right? Blah, blah, blah. All of that stuff. And that's not something you learn on university. So it also depends on the seniority of the UX designer, UI designer.
Yeah. So just to keep keeping it simple for the new UX guy, girl.
Exactly. And learn from other people. Learn from other, because you will, at some point in your career, be in a position where the client will say, and now I'm talking from the UX designer standpoint, the viewpoint, where the client will say, I cannot afford two designers on this project. I expect you to also do the high fidelity design. And hopefully you can be in the game for more than 2 or 3 years before you you need to jump into that. But you will end there at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something very interesting you touched upon just now. And I also want to ask you about it a little more, actually, about this. I've been in projects where there was one person responsible for both the UX and the UI design, and other projects where it was more split up. How is your experience with taking the role of both the UX and the UI designer versus just maybe the UX designer in a project? And what are for you the nice things about being able to just do both, and maybe also the cons?
True. So when I go out and talk to clients and I advise them whether they should choose which of the two models they should go with, if they have a strategic goal of making a kick-ass user experience, they should definitely invest in both roles and the split. And the reason being that although I can do UI design and clients are willing to pay for what I design, I don't think I'm that talented, but at least I can sell it. Some of my dedicated UI colleagues have skill levels that I will never possess. Well, they are just so immensely talented. So as soon as we talk major clients, they would want that level of creativity, and they are able to illustrate. I don't illustrate. I also don't do logo designs. They just come with another level. But if you are doing a business to employee application, an order management system, where it's like the main goal is data quality and efficiency, and you would kind of like the application to be somewhat, should I call it normative or conservative perhaps in look and feel, then you could argue that it's a one-person job, perhaps this combined role of UI UX designer with some experience that can do both. It could also be, sometimes I have clients that call to me and say, Thomas, we have this burning problem. We need this to be ready in 3 weeks. The designer who was on the project just left. We need someone to go and pick up and get done with. That's definitely not the time to send in two persons, because, well, it just takes time. And that communication between two persons, there's a lot of quality and value in that conversation, but it takes time. And if you're on a timeline of 3 weeks, that might not be the best option for the client to go with.
Yeah, and I think some of it sometimes also ties in with what we talked about earlier with doing design and UX before development starts, and then doing collaboration while you're developing. I've also seen projects where they would have a dedicated UX and UI designer for the initial phase and setting up all the business requirements and then building all the wireframes or prototypes or designs or whatever. And then once development starts, then actually the UI designer kind of stepped out because his job was quote unquote done. And then the UX designer would kind of take over on like reviewing and day-to-day collaboration. Yeah. And then also in a big project, you start to reuse a lot of components. So there's not that much need for like new UI. And then maybe when there's a new big feature that has a lot of new UI, then you maybe bring the UI, dedicated UI designer back in. So I've seen, I don't know if you have experience with the projects where you kind of start off being solely the UX designer and focusing on a lot on maybe information architecture and product owner requirements. But then maybe during development, you kind of take transition into kind of being the role of both. Where you start caring about the UI as well during development.
Exactly. But that's in, I would say, what the way you describe it there, that is the case in, now I'm saying, 8 out of 10 projects that that I've ever done. That's how it turns out. It also depends on the person, right? Is the UX designer comfortable with picking up that design task? There's a human factor in all of this as well. That's what I'm saying. But it's it's a cost versus risk assessment always. And that's why we bring in the skilled people to begin with, right? That's because we, if we don't do it right initially, then it's a risk. And that's why we invest in UI designers heavily in the first part of the project. Kevin, you have a child who needs attention, it sounds like.
Is that me?
Yeah. It's fair enough. It's fair enough. Actually, I think we're getting close I would say closing off this topic right here. But I did have one interesting thought. It's not something we necessarily need to dig deep into, but you mentioned this about high fidelity design versus wireframes as such, right? And we've talked about it between us as developers and you know UI UX designers. But there's a very important thing there, and that is, at least to me, I've experienced this, and maybe you have too. Is the expectations from the client about what is this thing here, right? Because I ran into the thing where, you know, because they look so high fidelity and they really aren't Figma, right? Is that they looked at the design and said one-to-one, this is how the UI needs to look when I look in the browser, right? Like it became the source of truth. And historically that, for this project at least, that was not the case. And that's, you know, it's a fair assumption to make because you're looking at something that could be the end product, right? So I think there needs to be a communication bit about, you know, what are the expectations, just so that the client are in agreement, or that, you know, it's just mentioned somewhere. It's just I've ran into it and it created a little friction, like, you know, because, and yeah. not that I'm hot-headed or anything like that, but it was like, I looked at it, I was like, what? You know, it's like, okay, I got to go and explain, you know, No, you know, we're doing it like this, but that's, you know, that's that part of it.
But I would say that's back to the first topic we talked about process during implementation, like where with the developer designer collaboration, because if what has happened in the case you described would probably be that we need to deviate from the original design for some reason or another. But when you discover that, then you need to go back and talk to the product owner and say, well, we found out that there's a smarter way to do it. So let's do it that way, so that they don't get surprised when something else occur on screen. So I believe that part is mainly about collaboration and talking to each other. But I could be wrong. But when I have experienced that, that's because I have not been good enough at getting back to the product owner after I discovered with the developer we need to do something else. It becomes a double thing, and now I surprise attack with the product owner with something that we didn't agree on when we had that kickoff, you, me, and him or whoever it is, right? Initially. And then we need to keep them in the loop and say, well, we found out we've got wiser. Now we want to do this way instead. So.
Yeah, no, and also there's also a cost to updating the design. Like, because if it's like a one-off sort of project, right, where it's not like a product that lives on, then is it worth spending time updating the design as you go and make decisions on changing things and the whole like source of truth, right? Where is it, the code or is it the design? It's a
So my I would just say no. I never update design during sprints. It is worth investing in keeping the design system up to date. And that's where designers, developers also need to sit down and have a handshake on what is the truth, right? Because that's where it matters. That is the reusable components. That's where we should agree. But if the layout deviates a little on some screen or what do I know, right? And that there's in my case, especially if it's an experienced developer I work with, there's an 80% chance that the developer is probably on the right side of that argument, right? So let's go with that. So I think that's I think that's a split.
But I think it is definitely sometimes a discussion, like the whole like where is the source of truth, and I, of course, as a developer, think it's in the code, but
that's what we deploy.
Yes, some people does not agree, right? Because it's maybe some screenshots are in a user story somewhere, and that's the source of truth.
For the project in the code, but I guess the source of truth for the vision is then in the design. So it's
exactly. So I guess it's all about communication.
Well, that's exactly as my mentor told me, right, Thomas? You're never better than what is on the build server. And I know you're not sitting on a build server, right? But if I was convinced, well, I'm smarter on buttons than Miguel is. What he has done on Storybook is not the right thing. The button I have in Figma, that is the golden button. This is just theoretically right. But then I would need to go and start a dialogue with you and say, well, that pseudo class you have right there, Miguel, that might. I think it's too gray. There's accessibility issues. I know you have tested that, Miguel, but so this is really theoretically. but I need to go in and I need to make my case. And we need, and it's of course the code that we need to discuss. And I need to say what is the best for the end users. And that's why it's a joint responsibility between developers and designers to get the UX right. Because if I just have pretty components in Figma, it doesn't matter.
I agree.
So guys, now I've been babbling for a lot of time, but I also wanted to ask you a question. In my time, I have often met two setups of developers. Companies that say, well, we only have full stack developers. And then I have worked with companies where there are both backend developers and frontend developers, which are dedicated, like when we discussed UX and UI designers. But what are your take on the full stack backend split? Is it an advantage or is it a disadvantage?
Maybe I can go first here. I definitely think there is a big difference. I have worked as a full stack developer before. Before, like, I turned more into a more only doing front end guy. So, and I think it depends on the project and the expectations, I guess. Because if you're working on a project that where you are only using like components from somewhere, like Google Material Design components or something like that, a Bootstrap or something, then I think maybe a full stack is just fine, you know. But I also think that it comes down to ambition also, I think. And because if you're a full stack developer, then you don't have the time to dig into things like accessibility and like doing cool animations or like these really, really deep topics on like also design systems and testing. There's so many things, and you just can't also deal with databases and CMS systems and PIM systems and everything in the backend because there's just too much. I think like the front end that is its own role now. But I also think that in a few years, or maybe also like actually some like now already, like the front end is already multiple roles somewhere in some places. Like somewhere you have like a UI front end, and somewhere you have like more like a back end front end, or like a front of the front and back of the front, right? So back of the front is more like the logic and the JavaScript. Maybe it's just like a React kind of developer, right? Or Angular. So it is different roles already, I guess. So it is splitting up and specializing, I guess. That's the trend I'm seeing, at least. I don't know if that answered any of your...
But it does. It does, yeah. Definitely. So it's kind of like the split we discussed with the UI and the UX designer, right?
Yeah. That
you, yes. You, sometimes there's a business case for specialized people, and sometimes you just want a person who can solve the problem at an 80% quality level or 70% or whatever the threshold is. Right? Yeah.
Like, and also, like, everyone can write HTML and everyone can write CSS. It's not hard, but it's really, really hard getting really, really good at it, right?
Yes.
True. So it's like, so yeah, a full stacker can write HTML and CSS, but I don't know if they can do it in a, like, yeah, do it in a really deep and like, yeah, it's a quality and ambition question, you know.
Seen from my perspective, the difference in how I experience it is that if I have dedicated, experienced front-end developers, I get the experience that what gets deployed is often better than what I designed. And I should be careful what I say now, but I have a hard time remembering that scenario when it was a full stack developer who did the front end. And I often think when I meet full stack developers, I often dive into the discussion that so you should build the user experience around these standardized components, as you also said, Mikkel. Well, you just take the components off the shelf and you get the best out of them. And that's it's not that inspiring to work in this way from a designer's standpoint, I think. So
I also think that it maybe comes down to, and it might be controversial. I might some people might get angry, but I think that it also comes down to empathy and like caring about different things. I feel like front end developers tend to maybe in some ways care more about UX and design than a full stacker would be would do, and maybe that's a bit controversial, but I think that so.
That's a good point. I just wanted to add my two cents here as well, because I think like Mikkel, I started out full stack and I segued into front end development because I thought that field was very exciting. And nowadays, I think that it's a very good point, is that front end is insanely big now. Like as Mikkel said, you know, like the back of front end, the front of front end, like the different roles that would fit in with that box. And I think, and that goes for every field, I guess, because, and that's not to step on anyone's toes, because I bet you, and I've probably seen some of them, right? There are full stack developers out there who are insanely good, like very good, at their front end part, but also equally good on their back end part. And that's very few people that can do that, right? It's such a large field if you combine the two that you would get, I think, baseline mediocre at best, right? It's like you know a little bit of everything. And for smaller companies, that's just the way it was, right? You know, where I worked before, you know, wasn't as that big that you had front end designers, you had or front end developers, and you had, you know, UI or UX or even digital designers. So you have more roles, and that's just normal. And I guess a lot of people, especially if you've been in development for a lot of years, have segued from those roles into more specialized roles, because backend has that too, right? You have database specialists, and you have, you know, people that specialize in different architectures and what have you. But I think empathy, of course, is one of them. But you know, Mikkel just mentioned. But I think a very important thing is also like, what are you building? Because and that's actually back to the whole collaboration part, Thomas, where you talked about in relation to bringing in developers early in the process, right? I actually think it's very good to bring in, especially if it's a data heavy application, bring in your backenders, because they sit on that data. Mm-hmm. Like they have a lot of knowledge about how data is modeled. And because we've done that and had good experience with, like, you know, we built something, didn't think of pagination or server side filtering or whatever. And they were like, dude, there's going to be like 20,000 records here. We should probably break that up. And you know, they say this is probably a UX concern, so you take it from here, right? But they can bring a lot of things there, you know, because they sit on that data. And on the other side of that coin, because I think that's what Mikkel goes into, sometimes they might think more about the data than the people. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, what they, you know, is because it's their profession, right? So I think there's that part of it too.
Agreed. Well, backend development is a huge part of user experience as well. There was an old study saying that when you measure the end user satisfaction, performance, and this is some years ago, so performance was a bigger issue than it is today, but performance issue would account for 60% of the variance of the score you get in the customer satisfaction, right? And you know it, well, you have heard about Amazon say something like, if I lose 200 milliseconds on load times, the conversion rate drops by 50%. The numbers are not accurate, but they are big as I remember them, right? So it's and backend is a huge part of that. So so it's not only a front end and design game. It's developers and designers all together.
Yeah. It's also hard to say.
One thing I like. Take it.
It's just it's also hard to generalize, right? Because people are different, and you can't put like full stack people in a box and say they don't care about this and that. So it's to say that. So.
What?
It has evolved over time, right? The way you did front end 10 years ago is very different, and now it was a lot more static. There was a lot less logic living in the front end than there is now, and also just now tooling and frameworks, and there's just so many more options and so much more to learn. So I agree to some extent, and I already find it difficult to just be a front ender and like keep up to date with everything that goes on there. So I can't even imagine having to also keep up to date. Maybe the back end part is not, there's not much happening in the space quickly like it is in front end, but there's still new stuff coming and things evolving, so, and a lot to learn. So
I think there is. It's just invisible to us, right? Because we're not following those channels. But I actually think it moves fast there too.
In the old days, there was one webmaster, and now it's split into like 50 roles or something.
Oh yeah, the webmaster role. That's true.
One thing seen from the sideline, one thing that I really enjoy seeing is the change in how you look on the front end development skill. When I started, it was like back end development is prestigious, but front end developer is something any monkey can do. And I believe that some companies have been with resource front end development because that's not important. And I really hated those times. But today, a lot of the young developers are actually moving from back-end development to front-end development because they see it as a more complex and cool skill set, and there is not the stigma anymore. And that's been really, really good also for design and UX, right? Because that's important. We need the good guys and the skilled guys entering front-end development because it's a prestigious discipline, and that's a good development, I think.
Yeah, indeed.
Good points. I think we're actually nearing the end here. We've had a lot of good discussions. We've talked a lot about UX. We've talked about, let's not call it handovers, we've talked about when front-end development starts, how
development
we work together
and
tooling.
Ball.
Yeah. Development kickoffs. Sorry. anyways, I just wanted to say that it's been a blast having you on, Thomas. And there's so much more we could talk about. So maybe in the future we'll have the luxury of having you on here again. But I think that's us wrapping up for this time. Thanks for your time, Thomas.
Thank you so much for having me. And I would love to come back, Paul. But I'm sure that when you start editing this, you would look at this and say, well, we probably won't have this guy back anytime soon. But, but thank you so
Leave
much.
Leave that up to me.
No, it was a pleasure having you on. It was a pleasure to talk about.
So nice to see you guys again. Yeah,
you too.
And it is the most important topic for young designers to learn, that is to to get a good collaboration going with your guys. So keep on going. It's been awesome.
Will do. Thank you. Right. That's it for us, everybody. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Code Splitters podcast. If you like this episode, please share it with your friends or add a review in your favorite podcast player. You can also find us on Twitter at Code Splitters or on our website, codesplitterspodcast.com. Until next time, take care.